Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. This Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcast at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast, or it's simpler to use a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports and find advice for listening to shortwave at home. Please check out the website and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from France 24, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, NHK Japan, and Radio Havana Cuba. We will begin with France 24. First, a press review about the bill before the French Parliament, which will merge all public broadcasters together. It was revenge from some politicians who did not like their criticism. The bill has failed to pass so far. A press report on West Bank settlers who have been attacking Israeli defense forces, who shot and killed an Israeli 14-year-old, whom the soldier had mistaken for a Palestinian. Then an updated report from Jerusalem about the West Bank settlers and the Israeli right wing who accused the military of being leftists. France 24.
Starting here in France, French bills, MPs rejecting that bill, which plans to merge France's public broadcasters altogether, Dipti, directly affecting us as well.
Indeed, Stuart, the topic is dominating the dailies here in France today. This is the front page of L'Humanité, the French communist paper, which says that Rachida Dati persists, public service resists. Now, basically what happened on Monday is that French MPs rejected the text, which I'll explain in a minute, before it could even be debated in the National Assembly. Now, the text will now head to the Senate for another hearing. L'Humanité, like a lot of the left-wing papers, are rejoicing in this sort of dramatic turn of events on Monday. Nobody really expected that it would be rejected before it was even up for debate. In any case, that headline there, Dati's, in reference to this woman here, Rachida Dati, the French culture minister, who's spearheading this controversial bill. Now, Libération says, the left-wing paper says that the MP's outright rejection of the text is a, quote, slap in the face for Rachida Dati, noting she was also abandoned in that vote by Emmanuel Macron's ruling coalition. And in its editorial today, the paper calls it a total failure for Rachida Dati. They say she's failed for a fourth time in trying to pass through this controversial bill, accusing her of pursuing it dogmatically as a means to seek revenge on journalists who have reported and investigated her numerous corruption scandals.
Yeah, it is controversial. It's also quite complicated. But Dipti's found a piece in Le Monde paper which explains exactly what the reform is about.
Yeah, that's right. Le Monde looks at it on its front page, which also, before I get into it, it also reports there that, you know, it's not yet dead in the water, that the far right could come and could weigh in on the debate, which could help sway things in one direction or another. So anyway, the reform is concretely what some have called a French-style BBC holding. The proposal wants to merge the 3 major public services of France Télévision, Radio France and INA, which is the National Institute of Archives. Those opposed to it say it would hamper editorial independence, offer fewer resources at a time when public services and editorial independence are crucial. Le Monde here noting that the reform also comes at a time when all of these services seem to be doing fairly well. Radio France's podcasts are listened to by a lot of people. France Télévisions is holding strong against competition. Of course, though, they do face existential threats, notably from an aging audience or aging population, and also fierce competition from on-demand TV.
Moving to the West Bank, violence has been escalating once again in the past few days. Last week, settlers set fire to Palestinian property. Over the weekend, the IDF said they detained Israeli settlers in the occupied territory after they attacked security forces.
Yes, George, and Israeli left-wing paper Haaretz reported that settlers rioted and attempted to break into an army base after a 14-year-old Israeli was shot, possibly by the IDF, and the officer involved said that there was another riot in which his vehicle was targeted by stones, and that's when he says he shot in the air, thinking that he was attacked by Palestinians. And the Jerusalem Post here on its front page has an analysis that says violent Jewish settlers are a moral and strategic liability. It says that the last thing that Israel needs right now amid its war with Iran and in Gaza is IDF soldiers having to fight what it calls Jewish extremists. And then finally, again, Haaretz with this editorial named Quiet West Bank Pogrom in Progress. The paper says that the condemnation of the of all these attacks has been very weak, and it adds that it was only a matter of time before the settlers would start attacking Israeli soldiers who prevent them from carrying out their, quote, wicked schemes against Palestinians.
Israeli settlers assaulted security forces outside an army base in the West Bank. Now, according to local media, settlers targeted the commander of the brigade, calling him a traitor. This after the officer tried to stop settlers from entering a closed military zone following a settler attack that killed at least three Palestinians. For more on this story, we can go across to correspondent Noga Tarnopolsky, standing by in Jerusalem. Noga, good afternoon. Israeli authorities typically tend to turn a blind eye when settlers go and attack Palestinians. Now that Israeli forces are being attacked, will things start to change?
I think it's a bit more complicated in this instance. This is a government filled with extremists. We've come to forget it maybe over the last 2 years, but Netanyahu's prime minister, Netanyahu's top ministers are people who were considered beyond the political pale until they received appointments to be minister in charge of police or finance minister. And so, in fact, we have a government that has actively encouraged acts of violence and expropriation against Palestinians. And this is a government, starting with the prime minister himself, who have blamed the army for the worst security catastrophes in Israeli history and blamed them for betraying the prime minister and blamed them for being leftists. And so we're in a situation that, while very extreme, was predictable, in which not only did the Israeli government turn a blind eye to attacks against Palestinians that have escalated incredibly, but to attacks against Israeli soldiers. I want to remind our viewers that in the last year, two Israeli army bases were attacked by right-wing extremists. None of the attackers were prosecuted. This was just allowed to go with a blind eye and a wink, as many of the cases against Palestinians are. And Israel today finds itself in an almost anarchic situation in terms of the security of soldiers in the West Bank, certainly in terms of the security of Palestinian citizens in the West Bank. And it is a direct result of government policies that we've been following here on France 24.
Those press reviews and report were from France 24. France 24 may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English, and most podcast sites, as is the shortwave report. Next, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. Following an Israeli attack on a seaside cafe in Gaza that killed 30 civilians, including another journalist, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle interviewed Martin Rowe from Reporters Without Borders. They discussed the cafe incident as well as the unprecedented killing of 200 journalists by the Israeli army in its war on Gaza since October 2023. Journalists in war zones are protected under international law, and targeting them is a war crime. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
We begin in Gaza, where witnesses and the Hamas-run health ministry say Israeli airstrikes and gunfire killed dozens of people on Monday. One of those attacks reportedly killed nearly 30 civilians, including a journalist at a crowded seaside cafe in Gaza City. The Israeli army says that it will review the incident. And for more now, I'm joined by Martin Rue. He's head of the crisis desk at Reporters Without borders. It's good to have you with us. This seafront cafe that was hit, we understand that it was popular with journalists who would go there for internet access, for example. Tell me, what's your reaction to news of this attack?
As you said, the cafe was known for having numbers of journalists, notably for the internet connection. So again, we condemn very firmly this bombing of the Al-Bakka cafe. We know that one reporter was killed, Ismail Abu Hatab, who was a photojournalist. He was only 34. There is also another journalist, Bayan Abu Sultan, who was injured. We're still, at the time of talking right now, collecting information. Perhaps there are more journalists that have been injured, confirmed at Reporters Without Borders. According to our data, there are at least 200 journalists that have been killed in the Gaza Strip since October 2023, including 45 that were targeted because of their journalistic work or that were targeted while reporting. Well, and for that, we have raised so far four complaints with the ICC against the Israeli army.
I want to ask you, too, about the dangers that journalists face trying to report from Gaza, because we've mentioned many times here that getting into Gaza for foreign journalists is practically impossible, but there are journalists inside the Gaza Strip, right?
Yes, of course. There are many journalists in the Gaza Strip, many very talented Palestinian journalists from the Gaza Strip that are facing great danger trying to report on this Israeli military aggression on the Gaza Strip. As I just said before, 200 of them have been killed since October 2023. I think we should pause and reflect on this number. Like we've been repeating in the media that us at Reporters Without Borders that 200 Palestinian journalists have been killed since October 2023. But this is a huge number. This is unacceptable. This is unprecedented. And again, in many of these cases, we can conclude that they were intentionally targeted. Mm-hmm. And so far, we're not seeing enough pressure on the Israeli government, on the Israeli army, for this to stop.
Martin, what kind of obligation does Israel have to protect journalists in war zones under international law?
You know, not only Israel, but this is simply international law. And that's why I mentioned before that we have raised so far four complaints with the ICC against the Israeli army, because targeting journalists is a war crime. Journalists have to be protected, even in war zones. So yes, Israel has to commit to this, because this is international law, and this is not only targeted against Israel. This is something that we've been saying at Reporters Without Borders everywhere in the world when it was necessary.
Yeah. Martin Rue, head of the crisis desk at Reporters Without Borders.
That report and interview were from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com, as well as on YouTube at their channels called DW News and DW Documentary, and most podcast sites. On to NHK World Radio Japan. Trump has expressed frustration in trade talks with Japan. Japan is also frustrated, and this report expresses the view from Japan. It also includes some history of the tariff conflict between the massive business partners. Zelensky wants to pull Ukraine from the Ottawa Convention, which bans anti-personnel landmines. Recently, Poland and Finland said they are withdrawing from the treaty as well. Ukraine carried out a drone strike on a Russian factory 800 miles across the border. NHK Japan.
U.S. President Donald Trump has once again voiced frustration over the progress of trade talks with Japan. He says he's prepared to impose higher tariffs. Trump also indicated the current suspension of what he calls reciprocal tariffs will expire on July 9th as scheduled.
So I'll write him a letter and say we thank you very much. And we know you can't do the kind of things that we need. And therefore you'll pay a 30%, 35%, or whatever the number is that we determine, because we also have a very big trade deficit with Japan, as you know. And it's very unfair to the American people.
Japan faces a tariff of 24%. Trump has accused the country of carrying out what he calls unfair trade practices, specifically in regard to agriculture and automobiles. Officials in Tokyo say Trump's remarks could be an attempt to gain the upper hand in negotiations. They're working to ascertain his goals as they prepare for the next round of top-level talks. Business leaders support this strategy.
It's not worth overreacting to President Trump's every word. We'll accept his remarks in a calm manner.
Prime Minister Ishiba Shigeru refrained from commenting on Trump's latest words, but he's pledged to continue working to reach a deal.
Japan and the U.S. have been holding serious discussions to satisfy each other's national interests. We're doing our best to find common ground and will continue our efforts.
Now, Trump imposed additional tariffs on cars, steel, and aluminum, as well as call for reciprocal tariffs between March and April. In response, Ishiba tapped Economic Revitalization Minister Akazawa Ryose to lead a task force on negotiations with the U.S. Let's take a look back at how both governments are navigating this delicate landscape. On April 16th, Akazawa held his first tariff negotiations with his counterparts, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent and Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick. That was earlier than any other country. He also met with President Trump for about 50 minutes at the White House. Akazawa said the president suggested talks with Japan could be a top priority.
I relayed the message to President Trump that Prime Minister Ishiba would like to realize a comprehensive agreement between Japan and the U.S. as soon as possible to strengthen both economies. I strongly requested a review of tariff measures.
Sources say the Japanese side proposed a system to lower additional tariffs on cars in accordance with Japan's contribution to the U.S. auto industry. At the G7 summit in Canada, Prime Minister Ishiba had a meeting with Trump, but it failed to strike a package agreement.
Japan and the U.S. have been energetically holding sincere discussions. We're searching out possibilities through the negotiations. There are some points we have yet to agree on, so we have not reached an overall agreement.
Last week, Akazawa visited Washington again, his seventh trip to the U.S. since April. Officials say Akazawa and Lutnick agreed to continue to work vigorously toward realizing an agreement that benefits both sides. But soon after that, Trump started complaining about Japan's attitude.
Dear Mr. Japan, here's the story. You're going to pay a 25% tariff on your cars, you know. So we give Japan no cars. They won't take our cars, right? And yet we take millions and millions of their cars into the United States. It's not fair.
And Trump now says Washington could impose tariffs of 30 to 35% on Japanese products.
Staying with Ukraine, Zelensky has signed a decree to pull the country out of a treaty banning anti-personnel landmines. The president's move on Sunday concerns the Ottawa Convention that prohibits the production and use of anti-personnel mines. Russia is not a party to the convention. A Ukrainian foreign ministry statement said Russia has used anti-personnel mines extensively as a method of warfare. It said that placed Ukraine in what it called an unequal and unjust situation that restricts its right to self-defense. Media reports say Ukraine is expected to notify the United Nations of its withdrawal from the treaty after securing parliamentary approval. Other countries bordering Russia, including Poland, Finland, and three former Soviet Baltic states, announced earlier this year that they would withdraw from the convention. Ukraine has carried out a deadly drone strike on a Russian factory more than 1,300 kilometers beyond the border. The regional governor said on social media three people died and 35 others were hospitalized following the attack in the central Russian city of Izhevsk on Tuesday. Ukrainian media quoted the country's security service as saying they targeted a factory supplying Russia's Ministry of Defense. The factory reportedly produces air defense systems and attack drones.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan. On shortwave, they're heard at 10 p.m. at 13710 or on the web at www.nhk.or.jp. All the times I announce are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. NHK is also available at most podcast sites. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could help support this program, like a listener in Portland, Oregon did this week, there's a link for online donations available at my website, outfarpress.com, or you could write to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Many, many thanks to everyone who's ever helped keep this freely distributed show in the airwaves. Please help if you can. And if you're listening on a public radio station, please help support them as well. We will conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. Venezuela reported an international conspiracy bringing weapons across their borders to destabilize the country and justify a U.S. intervention. No one is sure if the International Criminal Court will survive the Trump administration pressure on Gaza. Iran urged the United Nations and Security Council to strongly condemn Israel and the United States for violating its national sovereignty. Radio Havana, Cuba.
Venezuela's Minister of the Interior, Justice and Peace, Diosdado Cabello, announced this Tuesday during a press conference the existence of an international terrorist network transporting weapons of war from Colombia to Venezuela to carry out simultaneous attacks against healthcare institutions, diplomatic missions, and representatives of the government and the opposition. Cabello provided compelling evidence of the conspiracy with connections from Colombia, led by Maria Corina Machado, and former presidents of Colombia, Álvaro Uribe and Iván Duque, who coordinated operations with narco-paramilitary gangs, criminal cells specializing in international arms trafficking, all with destabilizing purchases. The minister said, "This is a united plot. Here, the Venezuelan right-wing politics have completely lost their shame, their scruples. There are no scruples." He stated that in the coastal town in Sucre State, security forces dismantled a terrorist cell made up of four individuals, including a citizen from Trinidad and Tobago, identified as the main transporter of weapons to Venezuela. Members of the terrorist cell attempted to take refuge in Zulia State, where they were intercepted by security forces. Part of those detained were Venezuelan citizens, and others from other countries as well. Information was allegedly sold to the United States that there was a sighting of Iranian missiles in Venezuelan territory, a totally false accusation. Fake news. Information was sold with the intention of provoking an attack by the United States against Venezuela at the time of the attack on Iran a couple of weeks ago. Cabello denounced that this operation sought to give substance to Maria Corina Machado's rhetoric to find someone to validate her accusations, thus justifying U.S. intervention against Venezuela. He revealed that this gang, apparently dedicated to drug trafficking, had been reconfigured to carry out specific terrorist acts. He said that the seized weapons were not intended for drug trafficking, but rather to carry out attacks with high political impact. No one is sure if the International Criminal Court the ICC will survive the Trump administration's pressure. Its attacks on Gaza aid seekers continue. An exclusive interview with Cristiano Martiniello, a legal representative for Gaza victims at the International Criminal Court. Reporters asked about the potential legal ramifications over the killings of aid seekers in Gaza. The attorney for Gaza victims at the ICC said that Israel was violating international humanitarian law by setting up the controversial Gaza Humanitarian Foundation to deliver aid to the territory, which he added had been created to bypass the fundamental principles of humanitarian aid delivery, independence, impartiality, and neutrality. The attorney told Al Jazeera that intentional attacks on civilian aid seekers amounted to war crimes, which both individual members of the Israeli military and the GHF, the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, would have to bear liability before the International Court of Justice. Iran has urged the United Nations and the Security Council to strongly condemn Israel and the United States for violating its national sovereignty and territorial integrity. In a letter to the UN chief and Security Council president, Iranian envoy Amir Sayyad Iravani called for the recognition of Israel and the United States as aggressors against Iran. Iravani stated that attacks Iran's civilian nuclear infrastructure for peaceful purposes threaten international peace, undermine the non-proliferation regime, and violate Iran's right to develop peaceful nuclear energy. The Iranian ambassador to the United Nations cited a recent IAEA report confirming Iran's compliance with safeguard obligations, rendering the tax unjustified. A recent report by Israel's Haaretz newspaper quoted unnamed Israeli soldiers saying that they received orders to fire at crowds of unarmed aid seekers to disperse them, people merely seeking something to eat. A recent report also said that the bombardment continues across the Gaza Strip, continuing to get reports of a series of deadly incidents since dawn on Sunday.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is working well at radiohc.cu, but there's no podcast. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140, and from 6 p.m. to midnight at either 6000, 6060, or 6100. At their website, radiohc.cu, you can stream the English version at noon, Monday through Friday, Pacific Daylight Saving Time. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You do have to look harder these days because of U.S. and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for the show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find information for online support. There's a link at my website, along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 29th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. For 27 years, the Shortwave Report has been produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. While I'm still recuperating from a spinal injury, I'm staying in a house connected to the grid. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.